Hi, you're watching Stefan Levera Podcast, brought to you by Swan.com. Today, Killian from Bolts.exchange joins me on the show, and we're talking a little bit about what Bolts is and this idea of swapping around between Bitcoin main chain, Lightning, and a federated sidechain such as Liquid. And so we get into some of the different trade-offs around this, who it works for, and who it makes sense for. I think this will be really interesting to see because what's going to happen as fees rise is people are going to need to use other layers or sidechains. And so I think this will be an important conversation that people will have to have. So on to my chat with Killian. Killian, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Stefan. Nice to be on.
Yeah, so I had a chance to chat with you in person before at various some Bitcoin conferences. I know you're doing some interesting work with Bolts.exchange, and interested to get into it. So let's start with a little bit on how you got the idea to do this whole thing, Bolts.exchange.
Oh, yeah. So Bolts, yeah, interestingly, Bolts started out as a side project, really. The main gig we had back in the day, which was 2018-19, so actually Bolts has quite a history, was an atomic swap exchange, but decentralized. You know, the idealistic idea of having this decentralized atomic swap exchange. And Bolts was really born as a band-aid because this decentralized exchange was based on Lightning. We had actually issues for people to get onto Lightning and off Lightning. So Bolts was really born out of necessity for this main project to get people on and off in Lightning and easily open channels. And we had a couple of additional features for folks to open their Lightning channels from this for this decentralized exchange. So that's how Bolts was born as an idea, just as a fix. And interestingly, it's a thing that survived. So the other thing died off at some point, probably a little bit too idealistic. And Bolts became the new venture, the new main venture. But I would say it was a hobby project until spring 2023. So we only do Bolts full time with seriousness. Since a little bit more than a year now. So until then, it was basically Lightning to Bitcoin main chain only, nothing special, no new features for a couple of years. And since 1 year, we are on it in full time.
Interesting. And it's also fair to say that sometimes you build a service and maybe it's a bit early, just wasn't as much demand for it. And now that fees are starting to rise, at least on Bitcoin main chain, maybe now there's more of a use for this thing. So let's just make sure we keep this all accessible for everybody. So When we're using Bitcoin and Lightning, sometimes we need to swap things in terms of off-chain to on-chain or using Liquid or various things. So there may be different users who need to manipulate their Lightning channel balance. I guess the other aspect I would explain is that sometimes, let's say for the listener, you, the end user, might not really know about what's going on in the background, but actually your service provider, your LSP, your Lightning service provider, might need to use this kind of service in their background because it helps them save on fees. And so maybe that's another element of what this is. And obviously listeners of this show tend to be people who are more technical or more interested. And so we're going to sort of dive into more detail about exactly what this is. So if you had to just kind of zoom out at a high level, what does Bolts.exchange do today? What is the use case here?
In one very simple sentence, it helps you to move in between different Bitcoin layers, period, right? That's what it does. It helps you to move your Bitcoin from the main chain to Lightning, especially. Those are the two main layers we started off with. And now we are slowly, gradually adding more layers. So we added Liquid, in the past, and there will be more coming down the road. So what it really helps you as a user, we have different various, let's say, use cases or target users that do different things with Bolts. The main use case for most of our history was Lightning channel rebalancing. So it's actually for the more sophisticated users that probably operate a node, that do that for as a business, as a profitable venture. So they want to be a profitable Lightning routing node. That's was our main target user base for basically since the inception, 2019 until a year ago. And what they do is, what the use case here is that channels get imbalanced, right? So channels need inbound liquidity and outbound liquidity in order to be able to send and receive. So usually you run out one of the two. So in general, one could also say that the inbound liquidity, the that you can receive on a Lightning channel is the scarce resource on the Lightning network. So a lot of users use Bolts as a service to rebalance their channels, like send Lightning out to get inbound liquidity. So this is the more professional user, I would say,
Gotcha. So let's just quickly walk that through just to make sure everybody's following along, because there are times where we kind of get into these really technical rabbit holes and we lose people. So let's just, again, make it very simple. So let's say I am a merchant, as an example, right? And let's say I have opened my channels and I've been receiving, right? Because let's say, you know, business is going well, I'm doing lots of sales. Think about what's happening. So for users, just imagine you've got an abacus and there's beads on that abacus. But think of it like, what's happened now is because I, as the merchant, have been making a lot of sales, a lot of the beads on the abacus are on my side. And now there may not be enough beads on the other side of that abacus for me to actually receive new sales. And so what I'm doing, I need a service to be able to push some of those beads on the abacus back to the other side. And so in this example, right, so with Bolts.exchange, I might be the merchant and I might say, oh, look, I've got all my channels, all the balances on my side. So I'm going to use this service. I'm going to do what's called swap out. I'm going to push the balance out on Lightning and then take it back on chain in Bitcoin main chain or potentially on Liquid, right? That's one example. The merchant, let's call that the merchant use case. And then I suppose there might also be an LSP use case also, right? Or if you are a routing node, that might be another use case.
Exactly. So in general, I think one could summarize the liquidity problem, that's sometimes how it's called, on the Lightning network in a way that if you only do unidirectional, only in one direction payments, that's an issue on Lightning, right? So as soon as that's the case, like you said, with the in the example of the merchant only receiving, at some point everything is on my side and I cannot receive anymore. So I am forced to rebalance. I am forced to push Lightning to the other side in order to be able to receive Lightning again. Otherwise, my business stops, right? I cannot sell products anymore because I cannot receive. That's a serious issue. So that's definitely one use case. LSP use it probably in the background, and routing nodes, they use it for both directions actually.
Yeah. And I think one other point that's really crucial to make here is that a lot of people, when they think about Lightning, they're just thinking in terms of stock. They're not thinking in terms of flow and throughput. And I think that's a really crucial point that a lot of people, if you haven't actually used Lightning as a merchant, as a routing node, you might not really think about that concept. And so I think this is something that obviously you are very aware of this, Killian, and your business, because that's your business model, right? But just to explain that for people, imagine, you know, you might have set up a 10 million sat channel and you might think, oh, if I'm going to receive from all these people, I need to, I don't know, let's say over the course of the, you know, you could use that one channel, but you're reusing that same channel. That's kind of the point, right? Because it's not just the 10 million sat Satoshi channel. You might be taking funds in and then periodically rebalancing out such that you're getting some actual ongoing flow and throughput here, right? So I think that's an important point for people to appreciate, that maybe if you're new to Lightning or if you're not as familiar and savvy, you might not get that point, right?
Correct. Yes. Lightning needs flow both directions. It's designed that way. Yeah.
Yeah. And so then the other point is, you might be in a situation where you have this kind of unbalanced flow, as you were saying. Like, you may be, even if you are spending and receiving, it might just be that over time you're on net receiving more than you're spending. So then again, it necessitates using these kinds of swap in or swap out services to sort of keep the channels roughly aligned and in the direction to have liquidity in the direction that you need it.
Yes. So that's actually what we can testify for, as we've seen the usage of Bolts. Most Lightning nodes, most users on the network tend to receive more, have the more inbound flow than outgoing, at least the ones that are using our service. So they use our service exactly to counterbalance, right? So that's precisely the usage we're seeing.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so then let's talk a little bit about the other use for where maybe an LSP is using you guys as well, because that might be interesting to just talk through. What does it look like when an LSP wants to use Bolts.exchange?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I do not have a real world example of an LSP that is using us directly integrated in a product, because they usually have their own ways to manage the channel, or they have to manage the channel liquidity between their users. So an LSP is always defined as basically the entry to the Lightning Network, I think, like you introduced before. So there's one single channel between a user, maybe on a mobile phone, yeah, a mobile app, and the LSP, and then there's one channel, and then there's the rest of the Lightning Network, and it gives access to the rest of the Lightning Network. So the LSP's task really is to manage the liquidity of this particular channel. It's usually a private channel that's not available to the public, to the user. Usually LSPs manage this via Lightning native ways. So they're not necessarily using a service like Bolt's. In the example of Phoenix, for example, is a very famous Lightning wallet. They use a very innovative new technology called Splice In and Splice Out to manage the liquidity of the channel they have with their users. Breeze as an LSP might be doing a similar thing. Honestly, I have to look at it in detail how they will end up.
I believe they actually might be using you for the swap for this, like if they want to do it on-chain payment.
On-chain, exactly. But that's a different functionality in a sense that the use case is different. So this is not for the liquidity management of the channel, but this is giving additional functionality to the user. So in Breeze, Breeze is using Bolt to offer an additional functionality to the user to also pay to an on-chain address, right? So if the user says, okay, I'm a Lightning-only wallet, but I want to pay an on-chain address because, I don't know, a merchant is only accepting on-chain. They're using a Bolt swap to swap Lightning to on-chain and be able to pay this this on-chain address. So in that sense, it's an LSP using it, but for enhanced functionality.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, so that's an example where, so in that case, the Breeze user is Lightning, has a Lightning native balance, and if they need to make a payment to a vendor who only takes on-chain payments, that's where they are using you in the background, where they make the Lightning payment to you, and then you, Bolt, are making that on-chain payment for them.
Exactly. So this leads us to a second major use group that we're seeing since, let's say, 6 months, roughly. With Breeze, we have it since a little bit longer, but it's really taking off in the last half year. Apart from these very professional use cases of LSPs, routing nodes, or even merchants, which I would categorize as professional as well. We have wallet users. So wallet users that have the nice experience of having one balance only. So it's either a Lightning only wallet or an on-chain wallet only, or a Liquid only wallet, right? So these users, while they only hold Bitcoin in one particular layer, want to be able to pay to different layers. So it's adding this additional functionality to pay from on-chain to Lightning, from Liquid to Lightning, or receive via Lightning into my Liquid wallet. So that's a huge use case that is starting to take off for us now, where we are helping to enhance functionality for these wallets to make a very simple wallet, like a Lightning only wallet, actually a multi-layer wallet, by helping users to move to these other layers and be able to pay to these other layers.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And we'll get into more of that later. And we'll also get into the debate of what counts as a layer two, because I think that's another area around.
Yes.
I'm probably more on the unilateral exit side. So Liquid is
that's fine.
Not exactly a layer two for me. It's more like it's another service. But anyway, we'll get into that later. Let's talk a little bit about the other element here, because you are attempting to do this as a non-custodial service with an atomic quality. So can you just explain a little bit about how that aspect of it works, right? Because people might just be thinking, oh, is it just like a custodial thing? Well, no, it's actually a bit different here. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so most other services out there are actually custodial. So these typical interfaces where you go and you swap from one layer to another, there's usually a lot of, non-Bitcoin stuff involved. This is all custodial. Be aware of that. So none of them that I am aware of is actually non-custodial, right? So the default is custodial. So we thought we got to do that differently. Not only for the user to be sure that we cannot misuse funds, that we cannot steal funds, because that's the main thing why you would want to have atomic swaps in the first place. But also for us as a business, atomic swaps are a necessity for us to not be a custodian, right? So this puts us from a legal perspective in another box, right? So how it works is, if you want to do cross-layer atomic swaps, there's one key technology that is needed, and that's called HTLCs. So HTLCs are this magic bit of cryptography that we need on all the layers that we want to support in order to do the atomic swaps and be able to swap in between them. So that's that common functionality that all of them have to support. HDLCs are natively supported by the Lightning Network, and actually there's not much else, so you're kind of limited to HDLC anyways if you wanna swap to Lightning, in and out of Lightning. They are support on the Bitcoin main chain, they're support on Liquid, and they're interestingly also supported on all EVM-based chains. So we are currently also working on integration with Rootstock, which is a Bitcoin side chain, but has a fully fledged EVM. And there you can replicate HDLCs as a smart contract, right? So this is the primitive that we need on all layers to do atomic swaps. And how it works is, in simple terms, it has a two-stage process. So first there's I always call it like the lockup process. So both sides basically send funds, lock them up, and then there's the unlock or claim process where each side claims their respective coin. So imagine, for your listeners to visualize that a little bit in their mind, you have like a lockbox, right? So you have this treasure lockbox where both parties put their Bitcoin inside, and this lockbox it's just closed with one key, with the same key, right? So the same key is closing the box for both transactions. So in the case of Bolts, it's the user, for example, sending Lightning to Bolts, and Bolts is sending Liquid to the user. Both put the Lightning funds as well as the Liquid funds in the same box, close it with the same key. That's the key principle here. Yeah? So the HDLC is locked with the same key. Then later in the unlock process, basically the same key opens that lockbox and the assets are being swapped and go to the respective owners, right? So the key principle here is the same key.
Gotcha. And that's what gives this concept known as atomicity, this idea that either both parts of the exchange happen or none of it happens.
And that's the key idea here.
So that's what people say. That's what makes this non-custodial rather than a custodial swap.
Exactly.
So that can give people different qualities or different characteristics of the wallets and the services that they are using, and maybe that gives them more confidence in the services because they sort of know either it all goes through or none of it goes through, and so there's some confidence that people get out of that.
We talked about the wallets before that use us as an enhanced functionality to go to different layers. Those wallets, they market themselves as non-custodial. They shouldn't market themselves as non-custodial if the swap service they were using is actually non-custodial, is actually custodial, right? So it's a necessity for them to be able to integrate our API even and say, hey, we are non-custodial, like 100% non-custodial. There's not bits and parts that are custodial. That would be dangerous and difficult to understand for the users.
I see. Yeah. And so now let's just talk through the failure case, right? So people to understand, like, how is it working if, let's say, there are certain cases where, all right, so a quick example is maybe the user, it could be going the other way. The user wants to make an on-chain payment to you in order for you to make a Lightning payment out to somebody else, but your Lightning payment, let's say, fails because maybe that user was trying to pay a node that didn't have enough inbound liquidity, and that's like, you know, a failure mode. So could you just walk through an example of like how does that work so that the user can get his coins back, or the other way around in the Lightning swapping case?
Yes. So that's actually the interesting case you mentioned. If the user sends on-chain to us and we send Lightning out, that's the crucial, that's the difficult case. The other case is easier. We will come back to that later. Lightning payments fail for a lot of reasons. We know that, right? It's just Lightning. So if that happens, Lightning payment doesn't go through. Let's talk how we did it before. So before, what happened was the atomic swap actually had either a claim path where you could successfully go through and everything goes fine and both get unlocked at the same time, or there's actually a time lock in there. A time lock path, that's how it's called on the Bitcoin chain. So when you go through a time lock, you have to wait a couple of number of clocks, and then you could claim back your Bitcoin. So it was an active refund process, which, you know, UX-wise is not great, right? So basically users, if they use our web app or in the wallet, they had to wait, let's say, 24 hours until they could come back into the app, had to actively press a button, say refund now, get it back to my wallet, or in the case of our web app, even put in an address where they want to have their refund on. If they forget that, or if they don't, it's really hard to communicate. You have to wait until you get it back, and it's because of cryptography. It's not because of us holding the funds back now. That's, yeah, you know, UX wise, that was a real issue. That's why we upgraded to something called Taproot Swaps recently. We deployed it in January, and that greatly improves the UX of refunds. So Taproot enables something additional for the technical listeners of yours. It's called a key path spent. If you want to learn more about it, and we actually have a blog post up at blog.bolts.exchange, you can read up on it. So a key path spent works differently in that it doesn't need to adhere to what's already on the on the Bitcoin blockchain with a time lock. It actually can cooperatively sign transactions and broadcast them immediately, right? So in layman terms, that means the user and Bolts could just agree, hey, we don't want to wait, we want a refund now. If we both cooperate and both sign our parts of the transaction respectively, we broadcast it, the refund goes, you know, it's immediately, right? So if Bolts is online and users online and both do this cooperative signing process, the refunds are actually immediately. And that's the UX we're betting on right now. And that's what wallets are upgrading to and implementing right now, is actually that they do that even under the hood. The user doesn't even necessarily know that his or her wallet is doing this cooperative refund. So basically I say, bam, 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 transaction failed. Oh, that's bad. But then I press the back button. And the moment I press the back button, the refund is actually already being broadcasted in the mempool, and it's already coming back, because it's all happening automatically under the hood. The key path spent happened, and the refund happened immediately. So, gotcha. That's the refund process. It's active. We need the user's cooperation for that. But it's a necessity for the atomic properties to be capped so that only the user is control of the funds and not us. That's why it needs active participation of the user.
Back to the show in a moment. CoinKite.com are the creators of Bitcoin security hardware, most notably the Cold Card. I use the Cold Card as part of various security setups of my own. It's a really versatile and secure device that you can use in a range of different setups, whether that is in single signature, whether you want to use a passphrase, or whether you want to use it as part of multi-signature or with CEDEX, or there are just so many features that you can use on the Cold Card. The Cold Card is really good because you can use it offline and generate your Bitcoin private keys offline without even phoning home, without connecting to a computer if you choose. You can just plug it into the wall. Now, once you've done that, you can use the SD card to move information back and forth, such as your XPub or your output descriptor, so that way you can manage it on a laptop or a desktop, but while keeping the Cold Card offline. And so that's a really cool feature. I like using the Cold Card with software such as Sparrow Wallet. You can also use it on mobile with things like Nunchuck. The Cold Card has so many different features, and you actually learn a bit about Bitcoin while you're going through the process of learning how to use it. Over at CoinKite.com, you can get a range of gear, not just the Cold Card, but things like the Tap Signer or the Seed Plate, which is a metal seed backup product for your Cold Card, and all these other accessories like the Block Clock. So to get yours, go to CoinKite.com, get your Cold Cards with a discount using code Livera. This show also brought to you by Nomad Capitalist. This is a service relating to offshore residence and citizenship for those of you who are looking for ways to get an alternate citizenship or residence to structure your tax affairs so that you can lower your taxes legally and also allow you to do things like invest overseas. I left Australia, as many of you know, because I was annoyed about high taxes as well as the freedom or the lack of freedom given the COVID tyranny. But with Nomad Capitalist, they can help you strategize in terms of understanding what are the different options, because it may not just be one place that you're going to, it may be a combination of jurisdictions that you are using. And part of that is that they can help you strategize in terms of what options are available for you and also for your business. And so I think they offer a really holistic solution, and they can help you strategize as well as help you implement that plan. Now, Nomad Capitalist is working best for people with a liquid net worth above $1 million. You can apply over on their website. That is nomadcapitalist.com/apply. So that's nomadcapitalist.com/apply. And now back to the show with Killian. Yeah. And it's interesting that, you know, that's an example of Taproot adoption, right? We're seeing this protocol called MuSig2, which is underlying what you're using there. I had a quick look at the blog post of that. And listeners, I will include that in the show notes so you can read about it in more detail if you like there. And so, yeah, it's interesting to see that we're getting more Taproot adoption there. And as you said, that's the key path spend. So that's in some ways helping from a privacy perspective, or at least there's less heuristics that you can kind of make about that. And then in the other kind of cases, that's where the user is using a script path, and that's where you're disclosing that particular script path when you broadcast that on chain. So that's kind of
exactly. So the script path is always there as a backup, right? So in case, you know, we could just disappear, or the user never comes online, then, or not in time to do this immediate refund. So in that case, the script path always applies, and you know, like the user can refund by the script path.
Yeah, I see. And so let's talk a little bit about the actual fees here. So what are the Bolt's fees involved here, whether it's main chain or liquid fee? And if you could just explain a bit about the fee that the user will be paying there.
Okay, we take a fee. It's the fee for using the service. Reasoning is mainly it's our capital. So when you do a swap with Bolt, it's always Bolt's funds that are being used directly, not some other users. It's always our own funds that you swap against. We always swap counterparty, you may put it that way. So we have a cost, right? So we have a cost of running the service, we have a cost of development. So that's where we're taking the fee. So the fees are different depending on the direction and asset you use. In general, they are cheaper if you're going from the chain to Lightning, and a little bit more expensive if you go from Lightning to the chain, simply because we have an imbalanced volume. I hinted on that before, that we have a higher cost of you know, managing our liquidity because more people are swapping from Lightning to the chain. So for going from chain to Lightning right now is 0.1%, or 1,000 ppm for the Lightning people of your listeners, and it's 0.5% for the main chain and 0.25% for liquid going from Lightning to the chain. So between 0.1% and 0.5%, depending on what you're doing, that's the range.
Gotcha. And so the liquid fee you mentioned is 0.25%. That's if you are going from a Lightning balance into liquid chain?
Correct.
Gotcha. Okay, yeah. And so just to... if you could spell out for people a little bit around what kind of fee savings some people are getting by using these, you know, these different swaps, because I think that's an interesting dynamic to explain. I guess let me put this in context, right? So there are some people now who are talking about in a high fee environment, right, with all the spam ordinals, whatever that's going on, or even in bull cycles, like we get these fee spikes, and at that time to hit the main chain and use the main chain just a lot more, people would otherwise be paying a lot. And so that's where now we're starting to see some people talk about this. I know BTC Sessions is talking about it. Francis Pouliot is talking a little bit about using some liquid things. So if you could just explain from your perspective, or at least, you know, just from the user's perspective, where the fee savings are for using this kind of thing.
Okay, so the Bolt fee that I just described before is just one part of the fee. There's a second part that is the chain fee, right? So in order for you to send on the chain or to receive on chain, there are chain transactions involved. In the case of atomic swap, it's actually always two. So it's fairly expensive and it adds up, especially if you're using the main chain. So if you want to do some quick math, you'll always have a cost saving, to put it really simple, to use the liquid side chain instead of the main chain if main chain fees are higher than one sub per VBAT. So that's basically the math. So main chain fees had to permanently go back to one sub per VBAT if they wanted to compete with the fees that you're paying on the liquid chain. So the Bolt fee is you know, it is what it is, and it doesn't really discriminate between the layers in that sense. But the chain fee is the important part that you want to look at. And on the main chain, this can easily go up to being, you know, like 10% of your swap, or 20, 30, depending on how much you swap and what the current fees are. But it's significant. So that's the only thing to remember. Main chain fees are significant. And you really only want to use direct main chain swaps if you're doing, let's say, larger amounts. And you're probably, you know, timing a little bit where the current mempool is, and you're timing the swap you're doing. So fee savings are possible because the chain fees on Liquid are significantly cheaper at the level of 1 sat per V-byte if you want to compare it to the main chain.
Gotcha. Yeah. And so this is where, and I mean, I should just point out here, I'm sure, you know, not that you're hiding this or anything, but just for listeners to be aware, Liquid is a different trust model, right? Like Liquid is like a multi-sig.
Let's talk about it. Yeah.
You know, yeah. And we'll go into that, right? So there's 11 of 15 functionaries. That's the Liquid multi-sig. And so people can peg coins into Liquid. And this is where people are talking about someone like Francis Puglia, because he's running Bull Bitcoin. He doesn't want to have a custodial balance. So he's talking about this idea of, hey, maybe people should be using Liquid. Or someone like BTC Sessions might say, hey, if I'm stacking, I might use Liquid as an intermediary stage before taking it out on main chain. But while you're in Liquid, you are trusting the 11 of 15 in a sense, to not rug you. And that to be fair, there are swap in and swap out providers, of which Bolt is one of them. And so that's the main trust model that users have to understand. And this also comes into what we were saying earlier about this kind of what counts as an L2, what counts as a unilateral exit. So it's not a unilateral exit, but there are multiple swap out providers. That's the important trust model aspect people have to think about. Anything you want to add there on your side?
Yeah, don't put your life savings on Liquid or on any other layer 2 in that sense. So all layers on Bitcoin are making a trade-off, right? So nothing is as secure and as decentralized as the Bitcoin main chain, period. That's it, right? So your life savings should be in a cold main chain wallet. That's it. So, but you have to decide for yourself, what are you comfortable holding on Lightning in a hot wallet, right? So that's the hot wallet risk. It's a huge risk, and you need to decide what's the percentage of my net worth I want to, you know, be exposed on. The same with Liquid. There's no hot wallet risk, but you have, like I said, the risk of the Federation being malicious or of being forced by some nation state to do things. You know, it's a low risk, but there's a risk, right? The main chain practically doesn't have that risk. So it's up to you as a user, but in general, I would say if you're doing dollar cost averaging, which is what BTC Sessions explains in one of his videos, go up to amounts that you are comfortable holding in an actual wallet. Yeah, so that's the kind of mental model to compare to. If I'm comfortable holding $1,000 in my wallet, then it's $1,000. If I'm comfortable holding $10,000 in my wallet, then it's $10,000. And once it's $10,000 on Liquid, move out, go back to the main chain, put it in a cold wallet. But it's an intermediate step. You should not have funds there permanently, especially not for savings. That's the idea. The same goes for the channel rebalancing use case. It's all intermediate, right? So it's an intermediate step, an intermediate balance, and at some point you move out again. That's the idea.
I see, yeah. And so I guess the other question people might raise is this question of what if the regulators, and you mentioned this, right? What if regulators or the government goes after Liquid? They try to sort of say Liquid, or they try to find the Liquid functionaries and say, hey, Liquid functionaries, don't allow this person to peg out or block this person from pegging out coins for whatever reason. They may say AML sanctions, whatever. They may give whatever reason. They say this person's a drug laundering terrorist, whatever. Do you see that as a serious risk, or is it just more like this is going to work for now? Like, what are you thinking there?
Yeah, I mean, can it happen? Definitely can happen. The issue is this particular nation state will have, like, the trouble they would have is first finding the functionaries, because they are anonymous right now, so it's actually not public who of the Federation members are the functionaries. What we can tell is all of them are located in different jurisdictions around the world. So it would have to be like a multinational organization actually enforcing whatever they're trying to enforce. So it cannot be the states alone, for example, doing that, because they would have to find the majority of the functionaries in the United States where they, you know, actually have jurisdiction on. So the goal of the Liquid network is actually also to decentralize it more, to have it more decentralized in the sense that they're in even more countries, especially now in new countries where the law is actually favorable of liquids. Example, El Salvador, Argentina, you know, all the countries that are going a different route now, slowly probably move out a little bit of Europe and the US, like the classical West. That I think that's a very good idea. But it can happen, Stefan. Who am I to tell you? It can happen. It's a risk, and that's exactly what we're talking about. The probability is not that high, in my personal opinion, but it can happen, definitely.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it's fair to say that. I think it's fair to just make sure everyone's aware what are the risks of what you're going into. It's interesting as well that we talk about the risks of liquid, but at the same time, it's also fair to say there's a lot of these random shit coins or shit chains, like, as an example, Tron or Ethereum, that are being used for massive amounts of stablecoin transfers today, right?
Yes.
And it's also fair to say, like, I believe Tether, the corporation or the company behind it, has also been quite public saying, yeah, they interface with the US government, right? So the US government is getting a look into what's going on in Tether balances, as an example. And so, hypothetically, I mean, the US government could go after Tron or Ethereum, right? Like, they could do that. And so that's the environment where, you know, we're operating in the world, you know, people who are using stable coins on these various chains, they're kind of using it in that way. But in reality, the real balance kind of sits with Tether, right? Like, and Tether underlying that is there's some US dollars in some bank accounts somewhere, and there's some US bonds or US government bonds that are being held by Tether. And so that's ultimately the trust model for some of those users who are using these different, you know, stable coins. Now, Bolt.exchange is not using stable coins. This is what we're dealing here more with, just Bitcoin and Lightning, obviously, and liquid Bitcoin, right? LBTC, which is like an IOU for Bitcoin, but it's an IOU held by, as we said, the 11 of 15 multisig, which is distributed around the world. So just to make sure people sort of understanding some of the trade-offs and the models there.
Just to add on a little bit on your comparison you had with Tron, also, we probably should compare it to a custodial Lightning wallets, right? So they are also, most famously, still a wallet of Satoshi, right? So it's one custodian holding your cash balance, your spending balance that you have in this Lightning wallet versus 15. I would choose 15 because, you know, that something happens to this 15 and that they can be forced to do malicious things is just significantly lower than this one entity, right? So this one big honeypot. This is really the danger I see. So I think the trust model is significantly better than having any one entity being the custodian. I think that's you know, the metal comparison we probably should do.
Yeah, I see. And so, yeah, we'll see what happens, like, if governments or the regulators go after some of the, you know, whether they, I mean, maybe they would go after Tron or Ethereum first, right? Before they even go for liquid people or liquid functionaries, let's say. In terms of let's talk a bit about sizing as well. So here, in terms of the asset sizes or the swap sizes, what kind of limits are we working with? From looking on the side, I think it's liquid up to 0.1 BTC. Can you just explain a little bit around the transaction limits you're using today?
Sure. On the main chain, we have a relatively high minimum swap size that depends on the current mempool, actually, to make sure that we don't create anything near the dust limit. The default limit is 50,000 Satoshi. That's the minimum you can do on swaps involving the main chain. But it goes up as the mempool moves, right? So if you are looking at our site at Bolt.exchange in a high mempool fee environment, the minimum swap size will be significantly higher. And back in May, we had it like 150,000 Satoshis, and folks were complaining that they couldn't do swaps because it was it's just too small. On Liquid, this is significantly lower since transaction fees on Liquid are reliably cheap. We enable swaps down to 1,000 Satoshi. So in comparison, that's like less than a dollar. I think it's like 50, 60 US dollar cents right now. So it is actually, you know, buy coffee use case. That's kind of the limit we wanted to reach with that. And with regards to maximum, we allow swaps on all layers up to a quarter Bitcoin right now. 0.25 BTC is the maximum.
Back to the show in a moment. Mempool.space is the leading Bitcoin and blockchain visualizer. You can visualize Bitcoin, you can see the Liquid chain, you can also look at the Lightning Explorer, and there's also a mining dashboard also to keep an eye on what's going on there. I use mempool.space all the time because I like to keep an eye on what's going on in Bitcoin's mempool. You can see when the fees are high or low, and that is also really useful when you are sending on-chain transactions because I like to use the estimates that are available on mempool.space, and you can use that to make sure that you get your transaction into the next block or with a good probability of doing that by using the high fee estimation. Or if you are a little more patient, you can use one of the other estimates. Over at mempool.space, they're continually rolling out new features and ways to visualize things. You can even search Bitcoin transactions by putting in the transaction ID, aka the TX ID for that transaction. If you want to sign up for the accelerator program, that's over at mempool.space/accelerator. And finally, the lead sponsor of this show is Swan Bitcoin. Over at swan.com, you can buy Bitcoin, you can learn about Bitcoin, and there is also a Swan Bitcoin mobile app available on Apple iPhone or on Android. So you can send in your dirty fiat using ACH or with a wire, and you can buy Bitcoin and also learn about Bitcoin. There are instant smash buys. You can purchase a lump sum, or you can set up an automated recurring savings plan or Bitcoin purchase plan. This is a great way to deal with the volatility of Bitcoin by just regularly accumulating some every week or every month at an interval and in an amount that you choose. Swan makes it really easy to learn about Bitcoin with a range of content and material, things like free books, free courses, free podcasts and newsletters. There's so much there that you can learn. So with Swan, for example, if you go to swan.com/freebook, you can get Jan Pritzker's book, Inventing Bitcoin, for free. So go and sign up, stack your sats over at swan.com. And now back to the show with Killian.
I see. Yeah. Okay. And so at current fiat prices, I mean, as we speak today, it's about 69,000. So, you know, I can't do the
quarter
mental math.
Yeah.
Whatever a quarter of that is.
A quarter of that is, yes.
Yeah. You know, So the other question people might have is, hey, what if the Liquid chain fills up, right? Like, what would happen then?
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, a typical Bitcoin block today, nowadays, in terms of on-chain transactions, roughly 3,000-4,000 transactions per block. But Liquid has a different, again, different model. It's 1 minute block times.
Yes.
And I believe it's smaller block size.
Yeah. Now, there we're testing around a little bit, but it's going back to 4 megabyte, like the same
as Bitcoin. Oh, I see. 4 million weight units or whatever. So yeah.
Yes. So, to sum it up, the capacity of Liquid right now, as is exactly the same as the main chain, even though they have faster block times of 1 minute. One block per minute. And by the way, it's exactly 1 minute. So it's not like statistically like in Bitcoin where it can vary like a lot back and forth. It's always exactly 60 seconds. So you can actually.
Right. Liquid has no mining. Yeah. Yeah.
No mining. Exactly.
Yeah.
Why is it the same? Because, we are using something called confidential transactions on Liquid and everyone is encouraged to do so. Which hides the transaction, the asset. So you do not know if it's LBTC or USDT or another asset which exists on Liquid, and they hide the amounts. So in order to have this privacy gain, there's a lot of cryptography involved to actually blind that. That's how it's called, to hide it. But that makes the transaction be roughly 10 times the size of a regular transaction. So 10 times the size of the transaction, but 10 times the amount of blocks with the same capacity equals same transaction throughput than the main chain. So Liquid right now has basically the same scaling limit as Bitcoin, which is a lot. You know, Liquid had to attract that amount of transactions permanently for a mempool to even develop. Yeah. But after that, I think Liquid is much better positioned to further scale up, namely increasing the block size. Because it's just this limited amount of entities that need to agree to do so. And also the amount of entities that actually run a full node and, you know, validate all transactions is limited. It's not the same design goal as on the main chain where we want everyone with a Raspberry Pi in a basement to be able to verify the Bitcoin blockchain. That's not the goal of Liquid. So I think it's fair to say that if that happens, meaning Liquid is very successful, we would see, adjustments like with the block size or even block speed increases, in a matter of weeks, probably, or even shorter, because it's just this small amount of entities, number of entities that need to come to a consensus and decide to do it. So it has it has the same scaling limit as Bitcoin. It's also blockchain. It doesn't, you know, scale to infinity, but it is much more flexible in what you can do.
I see. And so generally, these 15 functionaries, typically they are businesses, you know, and it's easier for, you know, professional staff to operate this kind of liquid node. So for their, from their perspective, raising the block size is not as big a deal. So that's one argument I see from the liquid proponents. The other one I see is they say, well, we could have lightning on top of liquid. And so that might be another, maybe that's like another level if there's a lot of liquid, if there really is a lot of liquid use. But again, it's kind of, I find it difficult to quickly and simply explain that trust model for a new person, right? So, you know, but at the same time, as we were coming back to before, it may be that a lot of end users don't actually have to bother with Liquid. It's actually their service providers who are going to use Liquid, whether that's, you know, Bull Bitcoin or I believe even Jack Mallers mentioned Strike. We're playing around with the idea of using this kind of Liquid swapping to save fees on their back end. And maybe they pass on some of those fee savings to the end, you know, user, the everyday, you know, retail user. So I guess that's where some of this stuff may go. And we're seeing also Aqua as an example where they're kind of like a, almost like a moon wallet, but using in a liquid base, right? So the idea is you have like an LBTC balance and you're using, you know, and I, as I understand, they're using Bolts.exchange in the background to do these liquid lightning swaps. So as an example, in your balance, you think you've got whatever, $100 worth of LBTC and you're paying out a lightning payment for $10 as an example. And so really what's happening in the background is they're kind of paying out some liquid to you in, at Bolts.exchange, and then you are making that lightning payment out so the user can buy his coffee or whatever. So I guess one criticism people have, as we've been talking about, is this idea that, look, you can't scale a blockchain with a blockchain, right? Like it just, you know, it doesn't work. But maybe the answer would just be it's more for the service providers at that level. And like you said, raising block size or lightning on top of liquid. But actually, one other question. While we're talking about, you know, some of these wallets, like as an example, Aqua, when the user is making an LBTC swap out to pay Lightning, Liquid has one minute block times, and I believe 2 minutes are required for confirmation. Does that mean on your side you're taking a zero confirmation and you're just kind of taking a bit of trust there? Because like if they want to make an instant Lightning payment, they can't just like be there at the coffee merchant and be like, oh, just wait 2 minutes,
wait,
I've made
minutes,
the payment,
yes.
You know?
I had heated discussions with Samson about this because he wanted exactly that use case. And I was like, okay, I get what you want, but let us look into it. And it turns out that Liquid is actually designed and will, in future also, will keep ZeroConf safe. So that's a major difference to the main chain, you know, with Mempool RBF and all that. And most miners supporting it right now. It's actually, it's simply, you cannot accept ZeroConf anymore, period, right? If you do, it's a huge risk you are taking. So in Liquid, it is designed to stay safe. And for your technical listeners, it's basically based on the fact that there's only one central mempool. Not like on the Bitcoin main chain, where you have every node has its own personal view on the main chain. The mempools all differ. It's also one mempool. Once the transaction is in there, we can actually get a confirmation from one of the functionaries that the transaction is in the mempool and will be included in the next block. Right. So that gives us, from our perspective, that's good enough for us to say, okay, we accept it. It's in the mempool, and immediately pay out the lightning, and you know, coffee doesn't get cold. So we are relying on that. We are part of the federation. So we have a say also if this technicality were to be changed. You know, we would have a say in this, and we don't want it to be changed because it enables all these use cases like you described with Aqua. So that's one positive thing about Liquid, that you have these design, like the freedom of the design space, you know, and ZeroConf is a major building block.
I see. Yeah. And so while we're talking a little bit about some of this, I think it'll be interesting to see, whether there are more integrations with other services and wallets, right? Because as we've been having, you know, as we've been saying in this conversation, it's often not that the, let's call it retail end user is the one using Bolts. Oftentimes it's built into a service, or it's built into some kind of, you know, there's like a service provider or a professional level person who is actually the one using Bolt, or kind of more actively doing it, while the end user is just kind of, it's happening in the background without him needing to know.
Yeah. Integration. Well, for end users, we have a couple of more integrations going on. And namely, I want to mention the great work that Bull Bitcoin is putting into the integration with Bolt. So they're building, let's call them libraries or a software framework for others to build on and to enable more Agua-style wallets in the future in a very robust and in a very, you know, production-grade way. That's what they're currently working on. Shout out to them. It's really great what they're doing. And Agua and a couple of... We actually have been contacted by a couple of more wallets which want to integrate the exact same model to use this library, right? So they're all, you know, counting on Bull Bitcoin to do their job. With regards to professional services, I think the best use case to mention is maybe merchants. That's something we have two integrations going on right now. Namely, Saprite and BTC Pay Server. So as a merchant, you can choose, or right now, if you want to accept Lightning, you basically have to have a Lightning node, or you need to use some custodial service, you know, like, I don't know, or hosted on Voltage, and which it's all maintenance, right? So if you want to avoid all of that, definitely don't want to get into the liquidity maintenance rebalancing game, but still want to accept Lightning, we'll actually offer a way to do so, and that is by using a Bolt swap, basically showing a Lightning invoice to the user that is actually a Bolt invoice of a Bolt swap, and then swapping the amount that the user pays into, for example, a Liquid wallet, non-custodial, right? Well, that wallet can actually be a cold wallet, right? So that's an additional professional use case that we want to enable first on Saprite, because it's pretty easy. We already have a swap client ready for that. For BTC Pay, eventually as well, we are currently working on integrating a swap client into BTC Pay.
Gotcha. And would that be like a plugin for BTC Pay, or what's the method there?
Technically not a plugin, but something similar. Yeah? Plugin would need extra development. It's only C#, and we're not very familiar with that. So we'll use an existing client that we have and plug it into an internal API of BTC Pay. But it will be you could say it's like a plugin. Yes.
Yeah, interesting. And so, I mean, that's another thing where, you know, those of us who want Bitcoin adoption, we want more people to use Bitcoin and be able to use these services. It's important that it's easy for people to kind of swap in and out, because not everybody is a technical wizard who can figure everything out and do it all themselves. They need these services and apps that make it possible for them. Or otherwise, they're going to end up going custodial, or they're going to end up... not using Bitcoin at all, or not accepting Bitcoin. And so, you know, I think it's a challenging thing, because in some ways I can understand, you know, there's the purist view of like, oh, Liquid is not Bitcoin and it has different trust model trade-offs, or are people being honest about what is the right way to explain this and explain the trust model of that. But at the same time, you have to think, most people today are using credit cards and fiat and, you know, PayPal.
Yes.
They're not even using Bitcoin at all. They're not even offering the option for people to use Bitcoin at all. And so it has to be tempered against that also of like, how, you know, realistically, how do you move the ball forward to get more people actually using Bitcoin? Of course, we want as many people to, you know, not your keys, not your coins, and have their hardware wallets and their multi-sig and all of that. But in terms of, you know, being able to have service providers who can offer a Bitcoin option for people, I think that's where something like this is important.
I want to actually call all builders out there, you know, we are just one part of the builder community that is building on Bitcoin, especially in Lightning. Be more pragmatic, right? So that's a little bit like, don't be that like hook on definitions and be that hard on being, like you said, like having the purest solution possible, because the purest solution possible right now is just not in the reach of the regular users mostly, right? And that's mainly because of fees or because of complexity, because of the UX. So I think if we're all a little bit more pragmatic and see, for example, Liquid as, you know, explain the trade-offs, make sure users are aware, and there should be much more education out there to for everyone to be aware what the trade-offs are. But it's ready. It's production grade ready system that you should use. It's there for you to use if it enables a much better UX for most of your users, right? Not for all use cases, but for those where it does offer a better UX, use it. You know, that's basically the approach that we are taking at Bolt.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, I wouldn't call Liquid a layer two, but I'm okay with, you know, people using it. Like, if they want to use it, you know, it's choose your trust model, right? But I think the real challenge for us as well is that, let's be honest, right? Like, people like you and me and listeners of this show, we tend to care about these things. The average user is not going to read a readme. The average user is not going to, like, they're just going to kind of click through. They're just going to go next, 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 next. Let me just use whatever and then deal with something. If there's a problem that comes up later, okay, now let me figure it out. And to some extent, I can't blame them, right? People are naturally lazy. They'll do the minimum possible. They'll use the most convenient thing. So I think that's maybe the challenge in where we are. But at the same time, you know, people should just use what works. Use the trust model and understand that most people today are using fiat and not even having a Bitcoin option. So, you know, I think it's important to have a certain level of pragmatism, as you said. I think those are kind of the key questions and key points I wanted to touch on. Any closing thoughts from your side?
Yeah, layer two. I mean, I'm happy to find a different definition for the other layers we are adding right now. I think Francis came up with a different term. I forgot right now what he did. By that definition, Lightning is the only layer two we have right now. We need more layer twos of the sort of Lightning, of the likes of Lightning with a unilateral exit. I totally agree on that. But apart from that, a bit. Like the vision of Bitcoin scaling in layers, in my opinion, it's coming to fruition right now, right? It's happening. And that's really, really great to see. It's being the different layers are being used for different things. Let's use them.
Yeah. One other question, just while we're here, I think this will be interesting as well, is around just fee dynamics, right? Because I would say this, the spam from last year was what really drove a lot more usage of, swaps, and that's what spurred you on to actually go and use Liquid, even if
I don't personally count as a,
you know, yeah. So do you want to just spell out a little bit of your thoughts there on operating in a high fee environment? Can you just spell out some of the aspects there, because I think you'll have something interesting to say there.
Yeah, it broke everything. So that's how I could summarize it. So for us, it was incredibly difficult, especially can refer back to the fee hike we saw in May 2023. That fee hike was extremely special in the sense that it just continued hiking. It never came down. It was not like this, you know, going up and down. It was just one direction up for a week and a half straight. So what happened to us and everyone basically is you put a transaction in the mempool and it's never gets mined. And you bump the fee, it never gets mined. You bump the fee again, it never gets mined. And you put in more capital and more, in our case, swaps going on, more transactions in the mempool. That was that serious that we actually had to shut down operations for like 2 days until the mempool, you know, did calm down and we got more of our transactions mined. Because in the end, what happened in simple terms is all of our capital was in the mempool. That is not only an issue for us, that's an issue for any service provider. And I think that can happen again. So if you move some crucial parts, at least as a backup plan, use it as a backup plan to a different layer that you have all the technology and everything ready to be able to continue operations without relying, you know, too much on the main chain, that'd be great. You know, that's where we want to be, where we want to be going. And I think, professional businesses are becoming aware of that issue and they're searching for solutions. So, and there you have the layers to go. So basically, make your pick.
As you said, I think that's what spurred a lot more use, and I arguably spurred your use of Liquid or to support Liquid also. Yeah. And that was what drove a lot of users who are now saying, hey, yeah, actually, it's not going to be keeping my life savings or a large business balance on Liquid, but maybe it's just an intermediary, let's call it like a staging area. Maybe that's an area where people can use that trade-off. While, you know, having open eyes about exactly what Liquid is, it's not the same as Bitcoin, but it can be useful. And so let's leave it there. Listeners, check out the show notes. I'll put the links there, but it's basically Bolt with a Z.exchange. And Killian, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. That was great.
And finally, I hope you enjoyed the show. Get the show notes at stefanlevera.com. Thumbs up if you liked it. That's it for me. Thanks, and I'll see you in the Citadels.